Hello, and welcome to Holden Village. Today is June 10, 2006. Our session today is entitled An Always Audacious Assurance, and our presenter is Michael Pellet. Session number 2006-6. Let's listen in.
In and ask him to burn the CD, please. And good morning to all of you.
Good morning.
Wet, holy morning. As we finish up, well, not really finish, but stop wherever we will be in this, our study on those last verses of Matthew's Gospel, what's been known as the Great Commission, and again, where we get our theme for this summer, I am with you always. And as we've worked our way through that, the first thing that I wanted us to note is that this is basically the only, second resurrection appearance in Matthew's gospel. It's the only resurrection appearance of Jesus to the disciples. The first one was Jesus to the women as they were coming back from the empty tomb, where he told them, you know, go tell the disciples, I will meet you in Galilee. And from that, the disciples, if you will, took the women at their word, which, as we know in that context, is already something incredible, is a sign of faith that the disciples thought they could, one, believe women, and two, that Jesus actually was risen and would meet them there. And so they travel to Galilee. And as they go to Galilee and Jesus meets them, we then saw how Jesus comes up to them. Again, what would seem at first kind of common occurrence, but in Matthew's gospel, that's extremely rare. That it's always others coming up to Jesus. Only in the Transfiguration account and here does Jesus come up to the disciples, again signifying something very special is going to happen. And as the disciples meet him, Matthew tells us that they worshipped and doubted. And I talked a bit about why the translation that simply says, and some doubted, is not really the best translation, I think. Because the way the Greek has it there, it notes that it's the same disciples who worshiped are the ones who doubt. And we ask the question if any of you here could worship and doubt at the same time, and you seem to think that to be possible. So I think that's Matthew's point too, that all of us as disciples are, if you will, doubting worshipers or worshiping doubters. From there, we moved on into Jesus' understanding of authority. And when Jesus says all authority, and that sense of authority is not that Jesus is some kind of heavy-handed, coercive, domineering being who's going to enforce obedience, but that this is the kind of authority going back to the root meaning of that word, which is to cause to grow, to increase. And so that Jesus is the one having all authority. Jesus is the one who is the source of our life, the source of our faith, the source of our growth. And we looked at other places in Matthew's gospel where he talks about authority and what's meant by that authority, and how that authority is given in heaven and on earth. In other words, something that deals with both our spiritual and religious and faith understandings, but as well has economic, political, and social consequences as well, and is inclusive of all nations. Having been given that promise, that encouragement that Jesus has all authority, then he says to us, go disciple all nations, baptizing and teaching. And we looked at that sense of disciple and discipling, and again, disciple literally means to bring to school. And so it is connected with this sense of teaching. It is living with and walking with and being with others over the long haul in terms of an idea of ministry and calling. It's not, again, the end of Matthew's gospel is not a kind of razzle-dazzle gospel where there are just thrilling and stunning resurrection appearances and all sorts of flashes and you know, have revival meetings and do all of these kinds of things. Matthew is having Jesus encourage us for the long haul of discipleship and the community that is always with others. And we talked about baptizing then. Is that baptizing into the name of the triune God, into the name of being a banking and accounting term to tell us whose we are. Like I said, today it would be saying something like under new management. And so the act of baptism is helping us understand how we are under new management, God's reign and rule. Links it up with that sense of all authority, being under that management and domain of Jesus. And we then moved into the notion of teaching and what that means. And it's still on the board, so we can look at some of that. That again, teaching for Matthew's gospel, you can trace it all the way through. In our last verse here, chapter 20, this is the first time that Jesus gives the specific injunction to the disciples to teach. That as we look earlier, that notion of teaching is Jesus' bailiwick. In chapter 4:19, he calls the disciples to be fishers of people. That phrase is an understanding to be teachers. But we find out at first that as Jesus begins his ministry in Galilee, he is teaching, proclaiming, or preaching, curing, and healing. When he calls the disciples and sends them out, we note there that what he does is he commands the disciples to preach and to heal. Teaching is specifically left out. That in fact, in 11 verse 1, we find out that once the disciples come back, then Jesus goes out to all those places the disciples have gone and teaches and proclaims. So again there, perhaps over against our common expectations, we usually think, well, Jesus goes and we follow. But here the whole understanding is the disciples go out first proclaiming and healing, and primarily healing, we noted, and then Jesus follows. Right? So that in that sense, Jesus follows after us in terms of this sense of ministry and proclamation and healing. As we looked at that understanding of the area for teaching, chapter 9:35 to 10:1, it's that section of Jesus sees all these folks of sheep without a shepherd, the harvest is ripe, where are the workers? We looked at that more closely to see the context for that. That, you know, why that sense of teaching, it's part of Jesus' compassion for the people that's there. To engage in that teaching, first and foremost, what we do, Jesus says, is pray to God to send out workers. And again, a very surprising term there, that word for send out, is the same word that's used when Jesus exorcises or casts out or sends out demons. And so if you want to, you could translate that verse, pray to God to exorcise workers. A sense that all the workers are already there, the teachers are there. It's just God kind of light a fire under them, cast them out, throw them out there to do that work. And again, given that and their gifts, they are involved in the harvest. Again, maybe a little different notion than what we usually have. We think about ministry in that is planting, sowing the seed and all of that. The imagery here is, no, that's all been done. It's time for the harvest, and we need workers for the harvest, and that's part of the community that does that. The community is the harvesters for that. Then we look finally at chapter 11, verses 28 to 30. That come to me, all you who are overwhelmed, overburdened, I will give you rest. And then that very ironic or almost contradictory notion that what is Jesus going to do to give us rest? Give us a yoke, which doesn't seem to particularly be an instrument of rest. Right? I mean, be nicer if he would have said, come and I will give you a lazy boy recliner. That would be my sense of rest. But that didn't happen. It was a yoke. It's a piece of equipment. And I think the imagery and metaphor there is that yoke, which is Jesus' teaching, is the equipment which will enable us to carry our life. When we feel fatigued, exhausted, overwhelmed, burdened, we can't go on, how are we going to carry out? It's because we have this yoke, the instrument of Jesus' teaching, which enables us to carry on, carry out, live our lives. And that's why it is a piece of good news. That's why it enables us to talk about rest and a burden that can be made easy, a burden that can be made light. One more sense about teaching that I think is very important and also works into the very last part of the verse. And that is Matthew chapter 23, verses 8 to 12. And if you would turn to that, please, and if someone would read that for us.
But you are not to be called rabbi, for you have one teacher, and you are all students. And call no one your father on earth, for you have one father, the one in heaven. Nor are you to be called instructors, for you have one instructor, the Messiah. The greatest among you will be your servant. All who exalt themselves will be humbled, and all who humble themselves will be exalted.
Okay. Here again, you can see a passage that is contrasting with the kind of teaching that is going on within Jesus' time and a different notion of teaching. He says, first of all there, do not be called rabbi, and of course the rabbis would have been the teachers of the time. In Hebrew, rabbi is a title of honor, and it literally means my great one. So that the teacher would be, the rabbi would be the great one, the master, if you will. And perhaps today in our academic world, And there's that connection, right? It would be, you know, calling all your professors doctor, because doctor comes from Latin docta and whatnot, which means teacher. Right? So, and again, the doctor is the honor. Well, you can earn it, but usually when you call someone doctor, it's a title of honor. It's an honorific title. So if we were kind of going to make this a colloquial translation, it would be the kind of understanding that Jesus would be saying, you are not to be called doctor. For there is one doctor of you, and you are all students. All right, so that in that sense, right, it's, if you will, Dr. Jesus. And we're all simply the students.
If we're to take this teaching of Jesus in a serious new way, I was just reading just the next verse, the teaching, Jesus bounces off these other guys that are teaching at the same time in such a radical fashion, and he gets nastier. The Messiah's teaching, from Jesus in Matthew, is the most protest language, the most venomous and filled with emotion more than any other gospel. Mm-hmm. Just that next verse, of how it shows how angry he is at the previous teaching.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, chapter 23 is the nastiest chapter in Matthew's gospel. I mean, there again, if you will, if you're, looking for, if you're feeling a little snarky and really want to tell someone off and not quite sure how to do it, you can read Matthew 23 and it gives you all sorts of great invective. You brood of vipers, you whitewashed tombs. I mean, all of those things are there in chapter 23. Yeah, and again, all of it is focused at the rabbis, the teachers, the scribes, and again, for their teaching and what they, again, that whole list, looking at this notion of yoke in terms of saying what these folks do are provide heavy burdens. Right? You just weigh people down. If we want to look at that, look at the beginning of chapter 23. Let me find that in English. Right? Where we see all of that criticism, and again, the contrast. Chapter 23, verse 2. The scribes and the Pharisees sit on Moses' seat. And again, the posture of a teacher is sitting. So we're right there. They're teaching, right? Therefore, do whatever they teach you, right? Not necessarily all saying the teachings are bad, but do not do as they do, for they do not practice what they teach. Right? We always have the phrase, practice what you preach. Here it's practice what you teach. And then verse 4, they tie up heavy burdens, hard to bear, and lay them on the shoulders of others, but they themselves are unwilling to lift a finger to move them. Right? So our heavy burdens on the shoulder. There's the heavy yoke. And so all the criticism happening here in this chapter is again the criticism of the way of teaching or the kinds of teaching, some of them, which make this heavy yoke, which indeed, if you will, make it unable for you to carry your life and carry out your life. Right? The kind of teachings that, if you will, to put it into law gospel terms, that sense of law that makes sure no matter what you do and how hard you try, you will fail. And in that sense, there is no grace, there is no help, right? They won't lift a finger to help. There is nothing coming to you. Classic distinction for folks who are Lutherans, but I think this is indeed the case. What's the difference between a command and a promise? Well, the command simply tells you what to do, but does not enable you or give you the power to do it. The promise gives you the power and enables you to do what is commanded. That's the distinction.
Well, I'm having difficulty with this question you just mentioned here. It says that or therefore, do whatever they teach you and follow it. Okay, they're teaching these heavy burdens. But do not do as they do, for they do not practice what they teach. So they're being burdened down by things which they don't do, and they put them on other shoulders. I mean, it seems like I'm confused in this process. How do people, they know what they're teaching, if the leaders aren't doing what they're doing, what they're teaching?
How do you know?
And then how do you filter out of that which is right and wrong?
Well, I think, first of all, part of the criticism there is they don't enable that filtering out what is right and wrong. The other thing there is that what they teach, if you will, to say to do them, right? We can go back to our understanding. What, at least part of what is being taught, is the Torah, is the instruction, is the covenant given to Moses, and Jesus would say that is good because he himself understands to be that full, or Matthew has him be that full interpretation and understanding of that covenant, that instruction, that teaching. But you see, what the Pharisees do and what the others do is they add to this, right? Adding on to it and therefore making more burdens.
Well, that's what I say. But here he's saying, do what they teach you.
Yeah.
And if they got all this added garbage, when you use the word,
yeah, yeah.
Then is he saying, do that too?
I think there again that the implication is what they claim to be teaching is Torah. And I think Jesus there is saying, when they teach Torah, listen to that, do that. That's
yeah.
good. The add-on stuff is where the problem comes in.
I think it's a fascinating parallel that, for me anyway, that a lot of Christians in the United States are so offended to think that the Ten Commandments will be removed from public places, especially governmental buildings and places that are paid for by taxes. But I don't find a lot of them interested in putting the words of the last words of Jesus up next to them. They're interested in command. At least some people that I know in our community, they're more interested in the command of what you shall and shall not do than they are in what Jesus commands from the Mount of Galilee as a new law. They seem to be more interested in Moses than Jesus. And they call themselves, after him, but they seem to fashion themselves after the old guy. And it's a head scratcher for me.
Mm-hmm. And the other thing is this notion, if we understand disciple as living and walking and being with folks, there you could say, well, there's no reason to have to, post the commandments out there on the kiosk or whatever, that... those kinds of things, if you're carrying out your sense of disciple and teacher, is what would be going on in your homes and communities. That would already be taken care of. There's no need for that, right? If we're doing our discipling tasks.
And in verse 5, it says they do all their deeds to be seen by others.
Right.
They love to have the place of honor. That makes so much sense to me. They may have known the Torah and spoken the words and even done some of the deeds, but they didn't do them for the right reasons. They were doing them for the recognition.
Mm-hmm.
That's easy to slip into.
I don't know if you intended to go on to that verse 13, but even though it's so negative, it sort of gives me hope, because maybe I do not have to listen to everything that I'm told.
except when I snore.
I knew you were going to say that.
Yeah, I know. No, that's right.
Is that wrong? I mean, that's the part that's so confusing.
What comes here too is the notion of Jesus is talking about a sense of discernment. I think that what we have here, you know, as he says too, you know, call no one Father, because there you have only one Father in heaven. And so again, you know, just off the cuff, you think it's kind of tough for Catholics, isn't it? You know, Father, Padre, that's gone. But again, that was a title that was given within Judaism to some honorific teachers too. In fact, I mean, one might even speculate, is there a little tension going on here between Matthean communities and their understanding of church and that, and certain Pauline communities and their understanding of church, because both in 1 Corinthians and in Galatians, Paul says, call me Father. I'm the Father of you. So, you know.
It's been real interesting to me, Michael, because in the area that I live, we are just churched out. There are so many churches. But there are new churches, covenant churches, names that they're, I don't know where they're getting the names, but very powerful people are just saying, I can't take this stuff, and I'm going to go create my own church.
Yeah.
And the Friends movement is becoming a lot stronger. You know,
mm-hmm. This whole phenomenon, what they call the emerging church or the emergent church, and what's going on in that, and that's all part of it as well. I think, you know, as we look at this, you know, don't call someone rabbi, don't call someone father, don't call someone teacher, don't call someone leader. All of that is, Jesus is not saying don't have rabbis or teachers or that, but don't call, in other words, I think the two key things here is to remember that in Matthew's sense of community and how the community lives together, it's, you know, and we kind of have to invent a new word for this, but we are all teacher students. Right? In other words, we all teach one another, and at the same time, we all learn from one another, and there's no distinction in that. And you know, in one particular area, one might be far more helpful in teaching than someone else, but in another, they will be the learner and not the teacher. Because the whole point here, and I think this is, again, don't call people rabbi, doctor, because the thing here is what Jesus is critical of is the whole notion of status. Because that sense of knowledge, of expertise, and it's the same thing today, right? It's the old cliche, knowledge is power. And if I can have more knowledge than you, then I get some status. I'm an expert, that's why I'm standing now, and I have power over you. And right, that power over can become that kind of coercive notion of authority, which of course Matthew is entirely against, because the authority belongs to Jesus. The authority is in the Word. And what is the alternative to the notion of status in Matthew? It is service. And that's where, in chapter 23, then, that scathing criticism comes in, right? Because the rabbis, the teachers of Israel, are interested in status, in power over. How can I advance my career? Not how do I serve my fellow brothers and sisters. That's the thing, right? That's it. And yes, there can be rabbis and teachers and instructors and leaders, but that's always with the notion of service. Because first and foremost, that's what discipling is. That's what teaching is. It is the notion of service. And so too, I mean, to take it, you know, Jesus here is not saying that we have to engage in self-abasement and say, now, okay, you know, if you really want to be good, you got to be everybody's doormat. Let them wipe their feet on you. No, right? That's not service either. But it is that understanding, right? Our office, our calling as disciple, as discipling when it comes to teaching, is always the sense of service.
It still gets to be a little confusing puzzle of what exactly does Jesus keep that's old, and what exactly does he throw away, and what exactly is new that he adds in. I mean, except for that rule of service, to serve without abasement. Are there other rules in Matthew that would lead us to, in a systematic of what we should adhere to that is new and what we should disrespect that is old?
Well, I think, again, the key for Matthew in all that would be to take you back into the Sermon on the Mount. And all of those things in the Sermon on the Mount, beginning with the Beatitudes, moving forward, in the sense of service. Thinking about that, certain kinds of parallels there. After the Beatitudes, there's no right. You are salt. You are light. I think our metaphors of understanding what this kind of service is about. If you think about salt and its functions, it's not self-abasement, but on the other hand, you know, if salt seeks its own status, however, salt is used for flavoring food, it's also used medicinally for treating wounds and all sorts of things, but it's always for the sake of something else. And if you do, right, I mean, if you say, well, I'm going to cook and I'm going to add some salt so we can really taste the salt, wouldn't be very happy, I think, with that particular dish, right? The salt enhances the flavor of whatever else it is you're cooking. And so, same here, service enhances the life of the community of creation around you. That's, I think, where Jesus would take us with that, where Matthew wants us to go.
Well, isn't compassion one of the big things?
Yes, but again, compassion, as it works in Matthew's gospel, compassion is something that is carried out again in his three key words here of to be compassionate for someone and for others means that you disciple, baptize, and teach. Those are the concrete ways of carrying out compassion.
You can't flip those. You can't say that you're teaching, discipling by having compassion. That'd be a monastic form.
Yeah, I don't think so. I because again, at least the way, right, the way Jesus or Matthew sets it up here in other places, right, Jesus has compassion and then says, we've got to do something. Think again in the feeding of the 5,000, right? the teaching. They've been there for 3 days. They're hungry. Jesus has compassion for them and turns to the disciples and says, "You give them something to eat." And they go, "Say what?" But it's the compassion leads to the more concrete sense of doing something.
So there has to be action with it.
Yes, that's Matthew in that always is right. The discipling, the teaching always involves action. That's why I said it's practical reasoning, practical thinking, application, living. Yeah, always action.
I don't know if that's part of the mission statement of Lutheran Social Services. But maybe that's not their part.
The action?
Yeah, rather than just having compassion. No, I mean where you have to be discipling.
Oh.
With compassion.
Yeah, I wouldn't know that. I don't know that statement.
Don't you think that's because it's lack of money for them?
Yeah, I don't know.
All right, let's move to our final phrase here, the last half of verse 20 of chapter 28, where Jesus says, "And behold," here, interestingly enough, the NRSV says, "And remember." That's okay, but I don't think it's quite right. I mean, maybe I'm too picky here, but this is again the Hebrew word translated into Greek, which the old King James translated as "lo." You can call it "behold," "look." Basically what it is, it is when you hear that word "behold" or read it, it's a signal to the reader or the listener that basically means, all right, now pay attention. The other stuff has been important, but this is really important, so pay attention. Right? So that whenever you come across a "behold," and that's why I think "remember" is not good enough unless you understand "remember" has a force too. Now pay attention. So, okay, what's really going on here? So Jesus is saying, and so that last word to the disciples is a pay attention word. And pay attention. Let me read it to you as it would flow in the Greek. "I with you am all the days until the consummation of the age." Again, grammatically, in English, this is terrible. Pictorially or theologically, this is wonderful. Why? Right? Jesus, the I am, which we know again, I am Yahweh, the Greek way of rendering that name for God. I with you am. In other words, the with you is embraced, is encapsulated within the very name of God, within God's own self. So that what you have here simply in the Greek, in the depiction of the sentence, is exactly what it means. Right? To be with God, to have Christ with us means that we are enfolded and embraced, included within the very God, the very Christ himself. Right? I mean, I think what a wonderful, kind of just in the sentence itself, telling us what it means, that sense of with you, right? It's depicted right there for us. Okay. that sense of withing or withness is always the promise of God to the people. And again, Matthew, who is so concerned and loves to work through the Hebrew scriptures, I think the understanding of with you and what Matthew wants to communicate here would be to say, this is a reference back to Exodus chapter 33, verses 12 to 16. Exodus 33, 12 to 16. And someone would turn to that and read that for us, please.
Moses said to the Lord, "See, you have said to me, 'Bring up this people,' but you have not let me know whom you will send with me. You have said, 'I know you by name,' and you have also found favor in my sight. Now, if I have found favor in your sight, show me your ways, so that I may know you and find favor in your sight. Consider too this, that this nation is your people." He said, "My presence will go with you, and I will give you rest."
Okay. Right. Kind of has all the key things we've been talking about here. Right? Moses says, all right, we're, you know, they're back there at Mount Sinai. And so now what's going to happen again? And Moses says, all right, how do I know, God, you're with us and all that? We have, and God says, I've given you, I've shown you my ways, my teachings. And they're kind of, well, yeah, that's good enough, or that's okay, but that's not good enough. I need more. And God says, I will go with you. That way you know my favor is upon you. So that the sense here too is, again, God's promise, God's assurance to go with Israel, to be with them. And so here again, as disciples are to go out, how do we know we have God's favor? How do we know that teachings and ways are going to be enough? That final assuring word that God, that Christ goes with us. Right? It gives us the courage to go in that command. Go out, move out, and make. It gives us the wisdom in our way of discipling. It tells us that there will be effectiveness in encouraging baptism. And it provides us with creativity and understanding in our teaching.
And the Old Testament image of wandering in the wilderness with the tabernacle, taking the tabernacle wherever you go, or going where the tabernacle says you should go, is kind of an image of dwelling with.
Huh? Right.
And of course, the first chapter, you know, quoting from Isaiah, including, huh?
Precisely.
And they shall call him Emmanuel, which means God
with us.
Yeah.
So that again, as we said before, Jesus is Torah, Jesus is temple, you could say, Jesus' tabernacle. And of course, that's picked up in the prologue of John's Gospel when you say the Word became flesh and dwelt among us. That Greek word for dwelt is literally tabernacled. In other words, made his presence among us. So that this here, I think again that Matthew's understanding of that promise of Jesus to be with us is, again, that sense, the same promise God makes to Moses, to Israel, to always go with them, to always accompany them. And so that's why, again, to put this in the context, to see the whole force of it, like we said earlier, in Matthew's account, there is no ascension, because Jesus is always with us. Secondly, there is no Pentecost. If you want to say, where's Pentecost in Matthew, we've just read it. I am with you. There's the Pentecost. The Spirit of Christ does not need to be, if you will, sent some other time, because Christ's presence is always already with the community. And as we learned earlier, and in baptizing, the Spirit's presence will continue to come to those who are joining that community. And so that sense here again that Matthew wants to emphasize is that the presence of Jesus in the teachings, in the Word, is precisely that which accompanies, which encourages, which strengthens, which protects, which guides. We could go on and on with those kinds of verbs. Our walk, our discipleship.
Is the I don't know what the Greek word for end of the age or whatever, is that used in other ways in Matthew?
Yes, it is. And it's used in two different spots. I'll get to that in just a second. I want to talk, before we get to the end of the age, the sense there, again, that last all the days, that the what's translated again, I am with you always. That word always in the Greek is all the days. And all the days is always, to be sure. I mean, but the notion there is to say all the days, it could be like every single day. It's that word of assurance that Jesus says, well, I'm not just with you most days, or I'm with you on good days, or I'm with you on rainy days when it doesn't look very good to go hiking, or whatever, but it's all the days, right? Again, that emphatic sense of inclusiveness that's there. There could be no day which would separate us from Jesus' presence. So, you know, bad hair days are not going to take Jesus from you. Right? That kind of sense, that notion there again of encouragement that's there. And then that phrase, what is it in the English here? To the end of the age, or until the consummation of the age. Two other places where it's used in Matthew that might help us understand that phrase are Matthew chapter 13, verses 36 to 39. Let's look at that one first. Chapter 13, verses 36 to 39. If someone would read that for us, please.
Then he left the crowds and went into the house, and his disciples approached him, saying, explain to us the parable of the weeds of the field. He answered, the one who sows the good seed is the Son of Man. The field is the world, and the good seed are the children of the kingdom. The weeds are the children of the evil one, and the enemy who sowed them is the devil. The harvest is the end of the age, and the reapers are angels.
All right. The seed here, again, that parable is that somebody goes out, sows the seed, and there's good stuff, and somebody goes out and sows the weeds, and that comes up too. And now the disciples are coming and say, well, now what does that mean? And so here's the interpretation of that parable as we have it in Matthew. And again, it points us to the end of the age, again, this the same phrase that we have at the end of chapter 28. But two things to note here. which again I think links us to the end of Matthew's gospel. The field is the world, not the church. Again, that sense of all nations and inclusiveness, that of all that is out there, we're not just talking about what happens inside the church. We're talking about what goes on in the entire world. And in that world, there is a conflict of words, of teaching. The Son of Man sows good seed and good word, and the evil one also sows seed or evil word. And it is that battle of words, that battle of teachings, which is, of course, so primary for Matthew. Again, what is it that, or to whom will you listen? And as a disciple, right, in that sense, we are all disciples. We all pass on teachings. It's just, whose teachings are we passing on? And so that becomes the issue. And again, whose word truly governs? Which word has authority? The assurance is, at the end of the age, as things come to completion, we will see it is Jesus' word that has that authority. And that again is part of the end of the age here. At the end of Matthew is trying to tell us that kind of understanding. The second place where this phrase comes up is Matthew chapter 24, verse 3. If someone would read that for us, please.
When he was sitting on the Mount of Olives, the disciples came to him privately saying, "Tell us, when will this be? And what will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age?"
Okay, so we see there's our phrase again, end of the age. Note the context. Jesus is on the Mount of Olives, one of our mountains, so we know there'll be some revelation, disclosure there. Jesus is sitting, the key word for what teacher, the posture of teaching. So Jesus is teaching on the Mount of Olives, place of revelation. The question there that's raised is, what will be the sign of your coming? And again, the sign of your coming, the word for that in, the word for that in Greek, and it's used elsewhere in the New Testament, is parousia. Now, the thing there, again, parousia has been understood, again, as that in secular terms, it was the state visit. You know, if the emperor is going to come to town, when the president comes to Seattle, that's a parousia, a state visit, a big time. In classical Greek, parousia simply means, this is, I think, just wonderful, presence. So that really, when we're talking about the parousia, we're talking about, when is the sign of your presence? When will your presence, because there again, if you go back to the, you know, the other thing here about a state visit, what's so important about that state visit is what? The ruler is present and can carry out his or her power and authority right there, right? I mean, up in Canada, right, when the Queen comes and everybody lines up just to have her walk past and go, hello, 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 right? I mean, but, oh, I was only this far from the Queen, right? The presence, I was in the presence of the Queen, you know, and you swoon and all of that. But that's what parousia is about. It's basically saying, Jesus, when will your presence be here? And now, as Jesus will explain in chapters 24 and 25 about the end of the age, it's also there in the end of our gospel, in that Jesus' presence is always with us, right up into the end of the age. So that again, Matthew doesn't have to emphasize a whole lot of end of the world, last time stuff. Because what's really, what some people would think is important about that, namely Jesus is here again and we're in his presence, Matthew says, that's always there. The end of the world just simply signifies now it's all been tied together. Now it has come to consummation. But don't think that we have to wait until whenever for Jesus' presence to be with you. It's with you now. And so that's a tremendous word of assurance and hope that says you are never alone. And it's also the thing that says, you know, kind of, no matter what, you'll make it. You will make it because Jesus is present.
And Matthew doesn't seem to be concerned about giving a sign, an evidence that the promise is being kept. There's no rainbow. There's no fire on the heads. There's no speaking in tongues. There's the epiphany has come down, and that should be enough for you. He's not concerned about evidence at all.
You have the word. You have the teaching. There, no other evidence is necessary. That's right. Nothing else is needed. You have what is sufficient.
And 11 people is enough. Are enough evidence. That's still it.
Well, you can even back it up for that. You know, 3 women are enough evidence. And of course, from those 11, as we now hear and read that teaching, we are incorporated into that. So we too are part of that evidence of that testimony.
But I think you want action with the with you.
Yes, but that with you is Jesus' action with us.
Yeah.
Right?
You know.
It's because Jesus is with us that then the teaching and everything else goes out with action. Our action follows from the action of Christ with us.
Well, I'm thinking more of crisis. Or does that not have anything to do with crisis?
Yeah, it certainly does. But the thing there is the crisis and our action in crisis will still be grounded in the assurance that Jesus is with us. Right? Crisis will not tear us away from this promise. Or am I misunderstanding you?
No, it's just sometimes when you are in that crisis, it's very, and you don't know what to do, and you're just, you know, everything is chaos.
But there, for Matthew, and why this is important, there's where you have his emphasis on community.
I see.
Because when you are in crisis, there are others within the community that will help you carry through. Mm-hmm. To kind of, you know, to keep going with that carrying metaphor. There are times when you're in crisis, when you're facing trials, when you will need others within the community to carry you. And there are other times when someone else will be in crisis and trial, and they will need you to carry them. Right. I think about that, I mean, it still might be the case, but it's kind of dying up, but certainly, and I remember churches, and I know particularly rural churches, when someone dies, everyone in that church community gets together and, you know, they bring over casseroles and cake. I mean, the community just overwhelms and carries that family with their support.
They plow the fields and do the harvesting and everything.
That's right. Whatever needs to be done will be done, right? The community will carry that family in their crisis. And when something else happens to another family, then, you know, that family that might have been in will be over there helping carry those folks. That's the kind of picture that Matthew has. That's the community that's there. You see, again, because nobody's talking about status. Well, that's gone, right? To say, oh, you know, only the pastor in the community gets to have all the pies and casseroles. No. It's not a community in terms of who gets to eat based on status. It's a community of who gets to eat based on service. And when you're hungry and need to eat, when you're in crisis and need help, the community is there for you. Because we don't make status distinctions. We understand ourselves as brothers and sisters in Christ in terms of service. That's what part of that teaching is about as well. That's the action that Matthew would have.
I really like the way that Matthew defines the Christian community as opposed to, I always get a little disturbed in this liturgical time of the year that Jesus has to leave. And I like Matthew's definition of the Spirit coming down and staying.
Yeah.
For me, it's much more comforting than all this language about the Comforter that will come to you when I leave. Yeah, and John.
One more. I know we're over time. Please bear with me. This is one of my little trivia things. But just kind of a historical thing, a piece of irony, something. There's a bishop, Ignatius of Antioch, and probably most of you haven't heard of him. There's no reason you should. But anyway, the interesting thing is that, again, as scholars try to think about the origin of Matthew's gospel and everything, they think Matthew's community is in Syrian Antioch, the same place where Ignatius is bishop of this city in Syria, Antioch. And Matthew's gospel is written at about the same time that Ignatius is bishop of Antioch. Now, we've talked about, right, Matthew's very egalitarian notion of community, right, the teacher, students, and all of that. Ignatius, who is also a martyr, and he goes to Rome, and on his way to Rome, he walks from Antioch to Rome, and as he goes, he writes letters to other bishops and head churches there, and most of those letters are all, you know, kind of prayers. Oh, when I get there, please encourage me, give me comfort because I'm going to be a martyr, and you know, when I dream at night about the lion's teeth, I kind of lose faith, and so bolster my faith so that when I think about the lion munching on me, I'll still be a bold confessor of Jesus. That's most of it. But then the other thing that he has is Ignatius thinks what's going to hold the church together is the bishop. He's the one, if you want to use the fancy terms, the one who first comes up with the notion of the monarchical episcopate, right? Which is the notion the bishop is, you know, the top on the triangle and everybody else falls under. And kind of where there is the bishop, there is the church. And he always ends his letters to all of these folks and others with the advice, quote unquote, submit to your bishop. Now, the interesting thing is, right, Matthew's gospel is written perhaps in that same community where Ignatius might be the bishop. So you have Matthew's ecclesiology with Ignatius' understanding of church. A little conflict there. What else? The other thing that I find so tremendously interesting is, despite that, Matthew's gospel is canonized. Ignatius's letters are not. So in other words, we say, what is canon? What is standard? What is authority for us? Matthew. And yet, basically, Matthew's picture of the church is not adopted. Ignatius is. I mean, the Roman structure of bishop, right, pope, is, if you will, the monarchical episcopate. So there you go. Matthew becomes the canonical gospel, the authority for us, and yet his structure of church is basically the one we do not follow. But Jesus promises, I am with you always. I think despite that,